Hello, welcome to the Theology Podcast. It's great to have you here today for a fun interview that we're going to have in a minute. But before our special guest introduces himself, we'll introduce ourselves because we assume nothing. We don't take anything for granted. This may be the first time you've listened to the show. Anyway, so I am C.R. Wiley. I'm a pastor. I serve a church in the Pacific Northwest. I've written some things. And the latest book I've written is In the House of Tom Bombadil. And I've been a professor of philosophy and real estate investor, yada, yada, yada. All right, you, Tom.
I'm Tom Price. I teach systematic theology, ethics, and philosophy. One of the places is Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary.
Glenn.
I'm Glenn Sunshine, senior fellow at Colson Center for Christian Worldview, ministry associate at Reflections Ministries, retired history professor, recent grandparent, a whole bunch of other things.
Nice. Now, our special guest is none other than Douglas Wilson. Hey, Doug.
Hi.
Good to see you.
Hi. Yeah, good to be with you. As just mentioned, I'm Douglas Wilson. I'm the pastor at Christ Church in Moscow, Idaho, which is up in the panhandle of Idaho. That's my day job, and I write, I blog at Blog and Mayblog, and my most recent book is Mere Christendom. So that's who I am.
Yeah. That's a worthwhile conversation too, Mere Christendom, but we're not going to talk about that one today.
Actually, if I can interject.
Yeah.
Doug, you have the finest blog title in existence. I got to tell you, I love that name.
It's a very Chestertonian kind of blog title, which is a segue into the subject. You've got a little book that you published here recently entitled Chestertonian Calvinism. And
yes.
That's what we want to talk about. So give us a little picture of what is this thing, Chestertonian Calvinism.
Okay, so Chesterton was one of my literary mentors. Another one was C.S. Lewis. Now, one of the things about Chesterton is that he is simultaneously edifying and exasperating. you're reading along and there's just brilliance here and brilliance there, and then there's a howler of some sort. Okay. And you think, oh, what are you doing, man? One of the howlers, basically, and this comes up again and again in Chesterton's writings, is his antipathy toward Calvinism. He never misses an opportunity to take a swing at Calvinism. And so that's one thing. But then, on the other hand, there was an essay of C.S. Lewis's where he's talking about, I think it's in his essay on Bunyan, but it's in his book, Selected Literary Essays, where he is talking about the early Puritans, and he is saying that all the connotations that go with the term puritanical have to be banished from our minds when we are talking about the first generation of Puritans, the early Puritans. And he said, and Lewis said, if I may, without disrespect, use the name of a great writer and a great Christian and a great Roman Catholic, the Puritans, were much more Chestertonian than their adversaries. And that is where the germ of this came from. There is a type of navel-gazing Calvinism that came later that Chesterton would do right to be hostile toward, introspective, morbid introspection. But the early Puritans, the early Protestants, the early Calvinists were not like that at all. And so taking my cue from Lewis, you know, me and Lewis, you're making the same one. Sorry. I'm hiding behind Lewis on this this point. Basically, I think that Calvinism is altogether lovely, provided the people who embrace it understand it the way the early Protestants did, where it's liberation from scruples, not getting tangled up in scruples. And that's what Lewis was talking about. And so what I had a number of thoughts about it, and I thought, you know, Chesterton would be highly annoyed at the title of a book, Chestertonian Calvinism. And so that was, I thought, an excellent reason for naming it that.
Well, heaven knows, Doug, that's unusual. You never try to annoy anybody.
Only when they're deceased. But
the fun thing, too, to think about is that Chesterton, in terms of his own kind of jovial disposition, is very Calvinistic in the sense you're describing. That's another irony of this, is that he's kind of the embodiment of what you paint as being the first generation of Puritans in their outlook.
Yes. When he attacks Calvinism, it's pretty clear that he doesn't know what he's talking about. It's not that he sees and understands and articulates what the Calvinists are maintaining. It's a misunderstanding that he is going after. And the kind of Calvinism that I want to represent is represented well by the ebullience of someone like Chesterton. He's a man who acts like God is in control of everything. So when I got out of the Navy and I went to university after the service, I majored in philosophy. And in the first year of studying philosophy, I've discovered Chesterton. I read the first book I read of his was Orthodoxy. And that book was sort of a lifeline of sanity for me. I was majoring in philosophy, but frequently my thought was, why are we talking about this? What's going on?
Right.
And Orthodoxy was just sort of this bracing, God is in heaven, man is on earth, you're finite, you don't know what you're talking about. That kind of bracing, the apostle of common sense. He was just really good for my soul. But I don't see it, the way he was good for me was not at all at odds with the way Calvinism did my soul good either, rightly understood.
Right. Well, this gets us into a couple areas that I think are really worth exploring. One is, you know, the value of, studying philosophy, just generally speaking, but then the hazards of studying philosophy, generally speaking, and having someone like Chesterton to kind of be your companion as you are, wading into those waters. But the other thing is, Chesterton, his background is fascinating. You spend a little time in the book talking about his childhood, his education, and stuff like that. Let's get into that a little bit.
Yeah, it's hard for us to imagine viewing Chesterton from in the rearview mirror, but he went through a real identity crisis, existential crisis growing up. He was smart enough to know and understand the implications of ideas, and he was a child of modernity and went to art school, didn't graduate from art school, but he went to art school and imbibed all the gunk of the modern hubristic era, and it caused him to crater. This is hopeless. He was brought to faith in part by his future wife, Frances Bogg, and first he came into the Anglican communion, and he had been baptized, I believe, as an infant, as an Anglican, even though his parents were kind of Unitarian types. He was baptized in the Church of England. He comes to faith, coming back into the Church of England, and then later converted to Roman Catholicism. But he went through a real dark night of the soul, and he's so full of life and insight, and it's hard for us to imagine that personality going through that dark a valley, but he did.
So one of the things that fascinates me, Doug, about Chesterton is that he's a bohemian. You don't grow up, I have a kind of bohemian background as well, and it's a very rare thing for people who are coming out of that kind of milieu to turn out like Chesterton.
Correct. You know,
any thoughts about that?
Yeah, he was a character. And sort of like one time he took a shot at Oscar Wilde, who was also that kind of character. But for Oscar Wilde, Chesterton said something, no, we can repay God for a glimpse of a sunset. We can pay for it by not being Oscar Wilde. But what he I don't want to make this sound disrespectful, but Chesterton had a shtick. You know, he had a way of presenting himself. He was in a certain measure, he was in show business, and knew it. He was a journalist and flamboyant and out there and memorable. He was sort of like, I would say the only other character like that would be our modern writer, Tom Wolfe, who went in sort of a surprisingly conservative direction at the older he got, but he remained a character to the end of his life. You know, dressed all in white and
the white suit, cape.
Chesterton was like that, and he was a bohemian type culturally, but he thought like a Christian, thought and reacted and taught like a Christian.
Yeah, and I also think there was a kind of even blue collar sensibility to him. He admired the everyman. You know, he wasn't overly impressed, I think, with, say, cultured elites. He had a way of, he was very comfortable. I mean, after all, you think about his debates with Shaw. He was a guy who swam in those waters like a whale. He was a big man and displaced a lot of water, but at the same time, he was a gracious guy. So like sometimes you hear the term winsome today and people have a certain sense of what that means, but I don't think they mean Chesterton, but if they did mean Chesterton, I would be on board with it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So the modern approach to winsomeness is to split the difference. Okay, you're over there and I'm here, and maybe I can, let me see how many things I can throw overboard of my convictions to make me more palatable to you. That's the modern understanding of winsomeness. What Chesterton did was he articulated what he believed and defended it to the hilt, and did it in a manner that was calculated to win the respect of adversaries. So he would travel around. He would debate Shaw. You mentioned his size and his debates with Shaw. He and Shaw were friends. They didn't just do the thing. They were friends. And one time, Chesterton, who was very large, Shaw walked up, and Chesterton was an Irish beanpole, just a skinny little scrawny thing.
Mean Shaw, right?
And so Shaw walked up to Chesterton, patted his stomach, and said, "What are you going to name the baby, Gilbert?" And Shaw, and without missing a beat, said, "Well, if it's a boy, John. If it's a girl, Mary. But if it turns out to be only gas, we're going to name it George Bernard Shaw."
That's great. That's great. Well, that also has kind of an edge to it. So there's a bite to the humor, but at the same time, it's delivered in such a way that you can't help but laugh. You know, that kind of thing.
Oh yeah, it's like there's a twinkle in the eye, or it's not. It's good natured. Yeah. He fights, and he fights fair, and he hits above the belt, but he's really fighting. And C.S. Lewis makes a point about Chesterton in Surprised by Joy, where he says that the dazzling display of virtuosity, Chesterton's verbal virtuosity, is because he's fighting. It's the swordsmanship, the movement of the sword is glittering, but the swordsman is not putting on a show. he's fighting. And because he's fighting, that's his intent. And you can see Chesterton says somewhere, the Christian who's fighting is fighting because he loves what's behind him rather than hating what's in front of him. And that good naturedness is evident in virtually everywhere in Chesterton.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Another point Lewis makes about Chesterton that I thought was really telling is he said his style of humor appealed to Lewis. Yeah. He said he doesn't tell jokes, he's not flippant, but the humor is an integral part of his argument.
Yes, it's embedded in the argument.
Which I thought was a brilliant comment.
Yes, yeah. That's very, his humor is part of the structure of his mind, and it comes out in his arguments.
Yeah, I think both of those points really hit to how rich an apprehension of reality someone like Chesterton had. And I think similar as Lewis, similar Tolkien, MacDonald, Traherne. I mean, there were figures in that world either influencing each other, but they were all drawn to. But it was something very important you mentioned earlier as being a philosophy student and reading Orthodoxy. This happened to me similarly. And it was that richness of what Chesterton had that the others didn't, that yes. I always found compelling. And you're hitting on it, this notion of humor, this notion of joy, this notion of imagination to be able to capture dimensions that rationalism or these other kind of dry reductionistic philosophies couldn't handle, that I think still make them very vibrant and, like you said, connect us to the richest forms of Christian faith, especially early Protestant thinking.
Yeah, absolutely. When I was doing my master's thesis in philosophy, one of the things I was assigned to, one of the things I was told, I was doing it on free will and determinism, and it was interesting because I was not yet a Calvinist at that point, but I was doing it on free will and determinism. And one of the things I had to do was I had to go up to the library and read in the philosophy journals. I had to read a certain amount in the journals. And I remember going up there and getting journal articles and sitting there by myself in the library, reading aloud so that I could maintain forward motion. You know? I thought this stuff reads like rapidly cooling magma. It's just, and I think, who are these people? What planet are these people from? And then when I turned to someone like Chesterton, who's talking about all the same great issues,
yeah,
but it's intelligible. Yes. The illustrations are windows that open you to the subject. They're not painted over. They're not painted murals. They're windows. Yeah. The humor is a window into the argument. And it's not like they're talking about complex stuff and Chesterton's talking about trivial stuff. That's right. No, they're talking about the same issues. Yeah. But Chesterton brings clarity to it, and there's a certain kind of scribbler that just obscures everything under magma.
Under pretense of intelligence. I think when I think about, you know, his background in the arts, it informs his writing. You've seen, I know, his caricatures, his doodles, you know, and mm-hmm. he describes like daydreaming about, there's this one, I can't remember where it's found, but he's describing laying on a bed and imagining painting on the ceiling with a very long brush. but that kind of like when you read Orthodoxy, you know, chapter titles like The Ethics of Elfland.
Yes,
and he's talking about something really serious, like you said, but he's drawing it in with a smile.
That's just absolutely correct. He's another thing I like to, and I think this lines up with the point we're discussing here. I like to point out how rarely, if ever, Chesterton uses a footnote. Yeah. Now, there are times when he could have. There are times when a footnote would have helped, but you compare how rarely he uses footnotes to how many footnotes he's in. So it's like an inverse relationship. This guy had something to say. He was intent on saying it, and he wanted to say it to as many people as possible. So he wasn't ashamed. He wasn't ashamed to write for the public mm-hmm. as a journalist. He's writing about eternal things for eternal beings, but the eternal beings would be everybody. It's not that the academics are the only ones who are eternal beings.
That's right.
Everybody is concerned with the great issues. Yeah. Everybody's made in the image of God.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's fun to see just how influential, even to this day, he is. Occasionally, I'll stumble over some offhanded remark by some contemporary intellectual praising Chesterton for something, and you'd never would have guessed that the guy had been, you know, he had read Chesterton. You know, I remember seeing a thing with an interview with Marshall McLuhan, you know, the guy who was the you know, kind of the father of media analysis and media ecology and all that kind of stuff. He said that Chesterton was, you know, the one who brought him to the Christian faith. And Theodore Roosevelt, I remember seeing a photograph of his desk in the White House, and there was, I think it might have been Orthodoxy, was sitting there on his desk. Just amazing how his stuff found its way into all these different places.
Right.
So when we think about this approach, and kind of the loss we see in the reform world of sort of the spirit and what that we're talking about here, how do we get it back? Do you have any thoughts on that? I mean, it's kind of fun that we can look to this Roman Catholic Chesterton as some kind of model for us as Calvinists to become more faithful to our Calvinism.
let me throw something in first.
Sure.
You know, you talk about the attitude of you know, freedom that you get among the early Protestants and the early Puritans and so on. People don't realize Luther was not the family name. The family name was actually Luder with a D. When he converted, now they had a habit in that period of always translating names into Greek or Latin for academic purposes. He decided to change it from Luder to Luther from the Greek word Eleutheros, meaning freedom.
Okay.
Yeah.
So by changing his name, he was proclaiming the freedom that he had in Christ.
Right. Well, that's kind of fun, particularly considering the book, The Dumb Ox, which is the biography of Thomas Aquinas that Chesterton wrote and his treatment of Luther in it. Luther doesn't come across very well.
Right.
But getting to this thing that we're talking about here, this joy, this freedom, this kind of spontaneity. What do we need to do?
So probably one of the best things you'll ever read from C.S. Lewis is in his magnum opus, which is English literature in the 16th century. Yeah. The first couple of chapters are sort of a history, literary history of Reformation era. And there are a number of striking things that Lewis says about the early Protestants there. Early Protestantism was saying farewell to all motive scratching, the internal introspection, that sort of thing. Lewis understood this, and that comes out in his essay on Bunyan, his comment about Chesterton, and in the first part of English literature in the 16th century. And what Lewis attributes it to is the preaching, basically the preaching of free grace, so recovering this ebullience that requires people to learn how to live as forgiven. Yeah. The gospel declares liberty to the captives, and we have to preach the gospel as though it does that. Yeah. And then the second piece would be to learn something about the early Protestants, the early Puritans. A great starter book on that would be Leland Ryken's book, Worldly Saints, where he talks about it. Basically, he shatters one caricature after another. When it comes to the Puritans, they were not dour or sour or gloomy. And as Lewis points out in English literature, their opponents didn't bring that charge against them. Protestantism was not too grim, but too glad to be true, he says. So Lewis talks about the battle between Sir Thomas More and Tyndall, and Lewis is very clearly in Tyndall's corner. And he recognizes both of them as great men, but he is very, very sympathetic to Tyndall. And this is the basically, I think, the secret sauce to the first century and a half of the Protestant Reformation. Now, some people want to say when the gloomy gusses started coming in, that they wanted to represent this as somehow uniquely a Puritan thing. But I would say that that is a weed that has grown in every Christian garden from Pentecost on down. Yeah. There have always been the fastidious, the introspective, the, you know, the Syrian monks, people doing that. And it was just a matter of time before that particular weed began to grow in the Protestant garden. And then, thanks to Nathaniel Hawthorne and some and Smith Wigglesworth and other people, that sort of, if they're going to hang me for a thief, I might as well steal something. If they're going to accuse, if they're going to be, accuse us of being dour, well, hey, yeah. maybe we ought to be dour. That was a late development. And again, Lewis points this out in English literature. He said it, and I'm not necessarily agreeing with his exact assessment of where it started, but Lewis says it's not until Thomas Cartwright, the English Presbyterian, that we encounter the Puritan of popular caricature. Yeah. Okay. That's a late development. The early Puritans were full of beans. They wore brightly colored clothing. My favorite example of this is John Owen. So I like to tell astonished students that John Owen was the quintessential Puritan theologian, and I own his commentary on Hebrews, which comes in 7 volumes. Yeah. And it's small font, right? So it's 7 volumes, small font, commentary on one book of the Bible, and the first 2 volumes are the introduction. Okay. And you think, okay, this guy is the quintessential Puritan, right? But if you met him, you would think you were talking to D'Artagnan of the Three Musketeers. Hat, plumed hat, yes. lawn top boots. You would think, you're the Puritan theologian.
Well, right.
Well, yeah.
You know, the thing about the situation we find ourselves in is that some of the contemporary people that maybe come to mind who are stiff and dour actually think of themselves as champions of free grace.
Right.
But they're kind of fussy about it and censorious mm-hmm. about it, that right. kind of thing.
Don't get me wrong. I don't believe that we're saved by big works or little works, right? We're not saved by tiny works, and we're not saved by great works. But that means that we're not saved by doctrinal works either.
Okay.
We're saved by the proclamation of Christ. Now, I'd like to tell a little parable. Let's say you got up to the pearly gates, and there's a desk there, and St. Peter hands you a pencil, and you see a stack of paper there, and he says, we have one final exam before you can come in to the blessed rest. You have to take your justification by faith alone exam. and so you look at that big, thick test, you look at the pencil, look at the desk, look at Peter, and you hand the pencil back to Peter, and he says, "Very good, you pass."
Right.
I'm saved by Christ. I'm not saved by a 98 or above on my doctrine exam. Now, it's what I like to, the illustration I like to use, and I think this is very important, it's the difference between the electrician who wires your house and the toddler who can turn on the lights. Okay. The toddler doesn't have to understand all the ramifications of sola fide in order to turn on the lights. Yeah. Right. But I do want the presbytery exam when we're ordaining electricians. I want the electricians to know how to wire a house. If they don't get sola fide right, then your house is going to burn down. Bad things are going to happen down the road. You really want to be scrupulous about the article of standing or falling church, according to Luther. You want to be scrupulous about that when it comes to your ministry. But there are all kinds of people who are confused on things that they ought not to be confused about, who are nevertheless saved. And the reason they're saved is because the Protestants were right.
Yeah.
We're not saved by works.
Yeah, I think that's very, very important point. I mean, I do this with teaching theology is a lot of times you can have these students that come in with this very hard, narrowed honing in of grace to just like three or four theologians they trust, and everything else has got a serious question mark. But when I unpack the doctrines of grace and their implications, I said the truth in the gospel is not in competition with any of this stuff. And so therefore it's not a threat to it. And therefore you can engage it and bring the light into it and force the light to shine into it. And you take what truth those early fathers had, and then you weigh the other stuff. You don't have to be scared of it. You need to be confident in the gospel rather than afraid of every little figure or thinker that may or may not have everything down to a perfect formula, and yet get some of the rich things that creation has given, even through these fallen, limited humans, that can help in our sharing the gospel in the world. So, yeah, it breaks down that competition and puts Christ in the center of it all.
One time when I read Anselm's Curdeus Homo, a great illustration of this, a marvelous masterpiece. But then in the edition I had, it had a collection of Anselm's prayers in the back. So I was reading, I read Curdeus Homo, and then I was reading his prayers, and this was clearly a man who loved the Lord. He was clearly a brother, clearly got it, clearly, you know, I'm going to enjoy meeting him in glory. And then I got to the prayers to Mary. I thought, man, what are you doing?
Well, you take that wrong turn.
But the point is that blind spot, he had blind spots, unlike us, right? So he had blind spots, and I can see that because this is Lewis again on the reading of old books.
Yeah.
When I read old books, I can more clearly identify their blind spots. If I'm reading 21st century writers, we often all share the same blind spot.
Yeah.
And so I need to be cross-checked. So it's really it remains edifying. So even when I ran into his prayers to Mary, that underscored how much I had in common with him, even though I'm as violent a Protestant as it's legal to be.
That's right. That's a great way to put it. I'm as violent a Protestant as it's legal to be.
But I think J.I. Packer, I think it's Packer, said that we are justified by faith in Christ. We are not justified by believing in justification by faith.
Right.
And, you know, that's, I think, I know people who are still trying to fight the words of the Reformation against Catholics. And while I've got a boatload of differences with the Catholic Church on things, that doesn't mean that Catholics can't be real believers, even if they're confused on their theology at a few points, as I undoubtedly am myself.
Well, speaking of Chesterton and having an appreciation for someone who's from a different theological tradition, there's Bunyan. In your book, you know, you note that even though Puritans are treated pretty harshly in just about everything from Father Brown to, you know, like you said, anytime he had a chance.
That's right.
But when it comes to Bunyan, there's appreciation. Can you get into that a little bit? Why was Chesterton able to see good things in Bunyan?
I think that Bunyan was a literary genius. And it's sort of expected in writers' workshops these days to sneer at Bunyan because allegory is not our jam. We don't like it, and Bunyan seems to be writing sort of I don't know if you remember those old Herblock cartoons, where every character had a little label sticking off of him telling you, you know, what he was and stuff. Allegory seems to us to be ham-fisted. And so it's just, it's not our thing. But Bunyan had sort of a pitch-perfect ear for natural dialogue. He basically invented dialogue. He's just a staggering genius. And I think Chesterton was sensible enough and good-natured enough to be able to see and recognize that. It reminds me, if you ever, I don't know if you've ever seen H.L. Mencken's obituary of J. Gresham Machen. It's really something, because Mencken says, Calvinism occupies in my private cabinet of horrors. It's right next to cannibalism. You know, so Mencken says, I just have a thing against Calvinists. But he said J. Gresham Machen was the real deal. He understood his faith. He thought in terms of it. He was consistent with it. And basically, Machen won Mencken's respect. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the same sort of thing that happened with Bunyan. And interestingly, Chesterton does the same thing with Cromwell. So Cromwell was a military genius. And so Chesterton says, basically, hats off to that guy. You know, he defeated this untutored military genius, defeats the English nobility on the playing field of battle. And Chesterton is a gentleman enough to see and recognize that, even though he's an adversary. And he does that, and he does that with Bunyan, I think, as a fellow writer and someone who sees how Bunyan is seeing the world.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's also a place in the book, your book, where you kind of, I guess, explore this a little bit when it comes to the Reformed and what our aesthetic is. So there are a lot of folks out there who say that we don't have one. And yes. my conviction is that actually the early Puritans knew what our aesthetic is, and it was of the verbal arts. And, you know, you have like Milton, you know, you've got these great epic poets and hymn writers and you know, popularizers like Bunyan, who were verbal artists. They were, you know, they knew how to write. And I think we've lost that somehow. And I don't think we look around and say, well, maybe there are people like maybe Marilynne Robinson or somebody like that every once in a while crops up who claim to be part of the Reformed tradition and are you know, appreciated more, you know, by everybody. But it seems as though we've, getting back to your earlier point, it's like, okay, there's this caricature of the Reformed that we're dour and we're
soulless. And soulless. Yeah.
Yeah, and soulless. And we're gonna live up to their expectations or down to them or whatever. So we're not gonna get into the arts at all, you know, because we're artless, right?
Right.
All we care about is abstraction and propositions, right? Yeah. So, you know, you write a lot of stuff. You know, you write fiction. You write commentaries. You know, you write, you know, topically. And that's what Chesterton did. You know, he was a, like my, like when it comes to the, my favorite books, you know, obviously there's Orthodoxy and Heretics, but, you know, The Man Who Was Thursday, you know, the Napoleon of Notting Hill, those are my, you know, some of my favorite works of fiction. How do we kind of get back to not just the sort of the joyfulness, but actually the literary kind of productivity?
Yeah. So that's a great question. And I think it's the same. The answer is the same as when we say, how do we get back to the joy? How do we get back to the ebullience? I think that that's got to be an experience of forgiveness, which comes from the preaching of the gospel. Yeah. Well, preaching the gospel is a logocentric activity. When you preach the gospel, you are preaching the word, and you're driving people back to their Bibles, which is the word. So Protestants invented the novel. That's our art form. And I think the Lutherans are very musical people, going back to Luther. And the Catholics had a long heritage of architecture and painting. And I think we can say credit where credit's due. But let's and without taking that away from the Protestants, the Protestants are not detached from the medieval church and what went before. If someone said, where was your church before the Reformation? I think the answer ought to be, well, where was your face before you washed it? Right?
Yeah, that belongs to us.
That's part of our heritage too. But when you focus on Protestants as Protestants, have we done anything aesthetically unique? And I think that Protestants are great artisans of the word. That's our heritage, and we have centuries of it. Now, I think because that's not the case, as obviously the case anymore, I think that's because we have drifted from preaching the word, preaching the gospel. If the gospel is the driving engine of our worship services, and we are sort of headfirst into our logocentrism, then I believe that you're going to start seeing distinctively Protestant voices coming to the fore again in the realm of letters. I think that this is sort of a natural law. That even a quirky thing, if I could just throw this in, Chaucer was prior to the Reformation, but I don't mind laying some sort of claim on him, because Chaucer was sponsored by, his patron was John of Gaunt, and John of Gaunt had another person that he was a patron for, a man named John Wycliffe. Okay, so Chaucer and Wycliffe are swimming in the same environment, and if you look at the Canterbury Tales, the one decent cleric in there, the parson's tale, when he quotes scripture, he quotes scripture in English. Right? What? Mm-hmm. So I would say that just as Wycliffe is the morning star of the Reformation, I would want to claim Chaucer as the morning star of Protestant letters. That sort of thing. But I think there's something inherently potent about biblicism. So when you throw your soak in scripture, and you understand, and you come to have it, as Spurgeon said of Bunyan, if you pricked him anywhere, his blood would run bibline. He would bleed Bible verses. And one of the things that has happened is Protestants have gotten a bad rap from the critics. Because when the critics read Protestant stuff, the older Protestant stuff, the critics don't know their Bibles.
Yeah.
All right. And so there are all sorts of illusions and things that they're being tapped into that just sail right over their right over their head. I was in a literature class once, and we were reading something by Thomas Hardy, and I forget which one Thomas Hardy book it was, but near the end, there's this line where Hardy says of one of the characters, Ephraim is a cake half turned, which is from Hosea. And so Hardy has sort of got a neon sign with a blinking arrow pointing at this. And the class was discussing, is this person's repentance sincere? And I think, look, he's got a poster. He's got a billboard here telling you.
Can you read it?
But if you don't know the illusion, who's Ephraim? Yeah. You know, if you don't know, you don't know. So I would say some of it has been Protestant proclamation drifting away from hot gospel preaching. It's our own fault, in other words. And some of it is the fact that the critics... To be an educated man today, you don't need to be steeped in the King James Version of the Bible. And it used to be that whether you were a heathen or not, if you were not educated, You were not educated unless you were educated in that.
Yeah. So bad now that, you know, you can throw in Shakespeare and just about the entire, you know, Western canon, you don't need to know. And you can still be considered educated.
Right. Yeah, well, you can see in that, I think, oftentimes, I mean, I think of it from the kind of the systematic angle, but the same point is when the rich picture of reality that scripture gives us starts to become fragmented. For example, when a word-centered faith gets ripped from the eternal word, Christ, who is the ground of both the logos of creation and redemption, then all of a sudden that word is also detached from creation and redemption starts to take on a Gnostic, if not anti-worldly character, and even it just loosens from anything. It becomes nihilistic in a way. And so go ahead.
Because what happens is that it's detached from you detach the word from the speaker. You detach the word, the signifier from the thing signified. Everything flies apart, and you are in a Heraclitean whirlwind, and nothing coheres. Nothing sticks.
Right.
Yeah. Another direction on this is I've thought a lot about Tolkien and Lewis as sub-creators, and it, particularly with Tolkien, Middle Earth started with words. It started with language. And the very act of creation or sub-creation for Tolkien and Lewis as well imitates God speaking a world into existence. So in a very real sense, I think that is the closest we get to the kind of creation that God himself does by speaking a world into existence.
Right.
As it happens, I'm currently reading George Gilder's most recent book, Life After Capitalism. It's a wonderful book. But he begins by talking about how the word information is primary. And he's answering the materialist superstition, which is matter in motion. And Gilder is saying, no. It's knowledge. It's the word. And he appeals directly to the Gospel of John. In the beginning was the word. Yeah. Information is primary. Wisdom is primary. The matter that's around us is simply the delivery platform. The information, knowledge, and wisdom is the salsa. Matter is just the corn chip.
That's the way. Actually, when the more one delves into patristic thinkers, one starts to realize that's what they're up to. That the spiritual for them, which is the mind of God, the Logos, is more real than the matter. The matter has less substance to it. It's the word that has the eternal word that is. And so when the word becomes flesh, that is an addition to Christ. And that is the thing. And it really gives us an insight to realities that the primary, and some will even say there's almost a concretion to spirituality in the way the ancients, the biblical world, thought about it. This is why when you get into the language about resurrected body and the material dimensions and the mortal takes on the immortal, this language is very rich. We're very removed from that. We tend to reduce everything to the least kind of reality there is when we talk about matter.
Yeah, I think it's easy to kind of pick on, you know, our own tradition, but I think this is such a pervasive problem. It's not as though there's some pocket of folks out there in Catholicism who are championing this. I mean, their own poverty when it comes to their teaching and preaching. Secular society is the same way. I mean, you go to the great institutions of our society, you know, Harvard or whatever, you don't find anybody who really embodies this sort of rich understanding of kind of the logocentric character of reality. It's all hack work and jargon and what's the latest set of terms that we are all supposed to parrot.
Yeah, we've all lost it.
Yeah, yeah. Getting to this sort of thing, like one of the things about Chesterton, it's fun, is I can pick up a book if I don't know who wrote it or I don't see the cover and I start reading, I can recognize Chesterton in like three sentences. You know, it's like, this is Chesterton.
Yeah.
Let's get into his style. Do you have any thoughts on that, Doug?
Yeah. Again, I'd appeal to Lewis's discussion of Chesterton's style, where it's not like you have this substance of his argument, like so much frozen yogurt. And then you go to the bar where they have the sprinkles and the M&Ms and gummy bears, and then you add the adjectives and the metaphors. You're not sprinkling the style on top of the substance. Mm-hmm. Well, you are if you're a hack writer. But if you're a writer like Lewis and a writer like Chesterton, the imagery, the metaphors are an essential part of the argument itself. And that's because Chesterton thinks that way. It's not like he comes up with a syllogism and then goes home for a day and says, how can I illustrate this? And then looks up in a dictionary of illustrations and then sprinkles that on top. Hmm. I think the illustration is there from the moment that he saw. It's simply part of the seeing. And you learn how to do this. I think you learn how to do this by reading people who know how to do it.
Yeah.
And Aristotle says that one of the marks of genius is ability with metaphor. You're saying this thing is like that thing, and they're not alike, and I'm going to put them together. And there's a certain twist. Yeah. I think it's a glorious twist in the mind that enables us to do that. And one of the here's another example, P.G. Wodehouse. You know, if you read P.G. Wodehouse, he's a master of the comic metaphor, but that means he's a master of metaphor, and he'll bring things together that just astonish and surprise you. And if you read a lot of Wodehouse, read a lot of Chesterton, Mencken is a pagan, but he does it as well. There are people who are just gifted at that. If you do that, those who walk with the wise become wise.
Yeah.
Those who walk with the metaphorical become metaphorical, which is another way of becoming wise.
Yeah, this reminds me of Lewis's comment concerning Aslan. I don't know if it was said about Lewis and Aslan or Lewis was reflecting upon, how he went about writing writing the Chronicles of Narnia. There's a tendency, I think, that people have that, just as you described, Lewis had this proposition that he wanted to make. And then he sat around thinking a lot about, how do I illustrate this? Oh, I know, a lion. I don't think that's how he operated at all. I just think he started writing about a lion. And he knew all of the associations with, scripture and the Lion of Judah and so forth, and just developed it kind of in a kind of intuitive way.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, Lewis actually says that the Narnia stories began with an image that he'd had years before. And the image was of a little girl carrying parcels in a wood where it's snowing. And what does this have to do with anything? And then he started to write. And then at some point he says, and at some point a lion bounded in.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this gets at something too. So like when we say that the most natural place for the Reformed to excel is in the literary arts, that doesn't mean that we are not enriched in our literary arts with imagery, visual imagery, right. Yeah. Or sensory data. It's just that we communicate it verbally. Metaphor is all about, seeing the connections and, the sort of in reality, spiritual things and physical things and how they correspond and give us some sense of their common origin and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because living in God's world is all about making connections. Okay, in the verbal realm, in the realm of writing, you're doing it with this word and that word picture and that this other word picture. A great Puritan in this regard would be Thomas Watson. He is one of the most pithy and vivid Puritans out there, and he has all these homely illustrations, and you go, whoa, just mind blown. But of course, a great painter is going to be doing the same thing, and a great architect is going to be doing the same thing, only in a different medium. A great musician is going to be doing the same thing, only in a different medium. And then we're longing for the day when all these different sorts of artists can be communicating more readily instead of locked up in separate departments. But that's not going to happen unless we recover the idea of the university. And right. We can't recover the idea of the university without a una. Right now, what we have is a multiversity.
Right.
The people in the physics department have nothing to do with the people in the ag econ department, who have nothing to do with the people in the English department or the art department. But you can't have a una without Christ, who's the arche that holds all things together. So when Christ is the arche, the logos, he holds all our words together, but he holds more than that together. He holds everything together.
Yeah. Right. Now, I want to play it with an idea here and just see what you do with it. So when it comes to writing, you've written a number of things. We've all written a number of things. I get the sense when I read Chesterton that he just kind of sits down with a pen and starts rolling. It's not like he sits down, you know, and just, you know, charts it all out and has a detailed outline. I get the sense that he's just kind of, it's almost stream of consciousness.
Yeah, you know, he sits down.
But he just has this way of doing it.
He's a barrel, and he sits down and opens the tap.
Yeah.
And he's a glug-glug machine. And there were times when he would be sitting there finishing up a column with the errand boy from the publisher standing at the door, okay, give me what you've got, and I'm going to run down the street with it. So he was writing on deadline. He was you're exactly right. He would just simply open the valve and go.
Yeah, I think that's actually another part of the key to Chesterton is that he was a journalist.
Yeah.
He had to produce. Now, fortunately, he had a mind that would accommodate it. But I suspect that the more that you write, the easier it becomes.
Yeah. But I think this also kind of gets to different types of writers. So like when I think of Tolkien, Lord of the Rings and the, you know, all the tales that have been posthumously published, all that kind of stuff. He seems like, you know, he just never stopped writing, but he was a fussy guy. The stuff that was allowed to be published while he was alive was pretty small compared to all the other stuff. You know, my sense is with Chesterton is like there's nothing that hasn't been published that he wrote. I mean, it's like everything went from brain, paper, out.
Laundry list. So Lewis once said of Tolkien that if you criticize something he wrote, he said either he had one of two responses. Either he would tear it all up and start over, or he would ignore you completely. He was a a fastidious perfectionist. So as he's mapping out the Lord of the Rings, he's making sure that the travelers are in sync with the phases of the moon. You know, he was that kind of perfectionist. And when Lewis wrote The Pilgrim's Regress, for example, which was his first Christian book, he wrote it in 3 weeks. Yeah. So he just sat down and out it came. And it looks like the Narnia stories had the same thing. It looks like the Narnia stories are this hodgepodge of minotaurs and satyrs and Santa Claus, Father Christmas. What's Father Christmas doing in here? And then Mrs. Beaver has a sewing machine, and you think, for crying out loud, where did they manufacture this thing? So Lewis, and it looks like Lewis is just doing all this slapdash thing, Michael Ward's Planet Narnia shows that it was not slapdash at all.
Yeah.
And it really, really works. But the fact remains that Lewis was more like Chesterton in being able to open the valve and have a coherent thing come out than he was like Tolkien.
Yeah. Well, we should probably wrap up. I mean, this has been a fun talk. Doug, it's been great to be with you here and talk about a subject that we all enjoy. And anything you want to kind of leave us with related to this particular book or anything else?
Yeah, you made me think of something earlier. We just, Canon Press just recently released this.
Yeah,
it's Calvinist poetry. And this was something I was provoked into by the topic that we're talking about, Protestant aesthetics. And what I wanted to do was answer the critics by assembling an anthology of Protestant Calvinist poets, which I did. And I put a few Easter eggs in there. there's a few. My big surprise, that won't be a surprise when I tell you, was being able to include Coleridge. Who was a Calvinist, and he was an oddball. He was an oddball Calvinist, but he was a Calvinist. And basically, we love our So basically, I think that one of the best things that conservative believing Protestants can do is recognize the apologetic value of beauty. I think we need to. I think we need to return to that, and we should return to where our factory settings as Protestants should include a word centeredness.
Yeah, great stuff. Yeah. Thanks a lot again, Doug, for the time.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Theology Pugcast and making it all the way to the end. And as your reward, you get to be reminded about Patreon and how you can support the Theology Pugcast. And if you would do that, that'd be great. You know, people, in different phases of life find themselves in situations where they have to cut back a little bit here and there. And sometimes that affects, folks like us. So there is a need. We do have to pay for the bills, pay the bills to make this show happen. None of us take any money, but we have to pay people who do make the show possible to do the job of getting it out there. And so your gifts are appreciated that way. Anyway, there's a link in the show notes. We'll also have a link to Doug's book. We encourage you to check that book out. It's a lot of fun. Chestertonian Calvinism. Anyway, thanks again. Bye-bye.
The Theology Pugcast is a ministry of Trinity Reformed Church in Huntsville, Alabama. If you like this podcast, you might enjoy another of our podcasts, The Good Life Podcast, featuring Matt Carpenter interviewing experts in their field about how their work contributes to the good life.